planet's puppet masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close-trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Where would we be without THC? 'Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
All right, people, we know the past is paved with high trickery from the shadowy elite, and when we really examine the history and the legal framework of America, you can learn a lot about how a nation that was once positioned to be a haven of freedom and independence was slowly sucked back into the clutches of what many call the Triple Crown Controllers. And that freedom and independence was replaced by a system of never-ending certificates, licenses, and identification more appropriate for processing cattle, instituted by a tyrannical Trojan horse federal government that was never supposed to be the all-encompassing, iron-fisted authority it is today. And maybe we share some responsibility in that, exchanging our freedoms for a constant need to ask permission, allowing ourselves to be regulated, numbered, and reduced to property of the state without much of a second thought. Well, today's guests, Corey Ibe and Todd McGreevy, have been working together to unravel the legalese and untangle the tyranny surrounding this subject for several years now, having hit it off at the Constitutional Sheriff and Peace Officers Association National Convention in 2012. They formed the show Common Sense Revisited, which has now become Agenda 31, which you can hear at agenda31.org, as well as following the No Agenda Show at thenoagendastream.com. There, they break down a lot of what we're going to talk about today, as well as follow Corey's personal journey, putting much of what he's learned about these subjects into practice as he personally fights the good fight against the agents of the system here in California. Two guys know a hell of a lot more about this than me, Corey and Todd. Welcome to the Higher Side.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you. Great to be on, Greg.
Of course. Thanks so much for being here, guys. You know, I tried to navigate that intro without saying anything too inaccurate or contradictory because this stuff can be quite technical when you get into the details, and I think I've covered some subjects like this in the past with guests like Jordan Maxwell and Kate of Gaia, but still, this is a little different, and you both made it very clear to me that we're not talking about the sovereign citizen stuff here. In this case, we're talking about being a citizen of one of the several states, and I think we should probably kick this off by explaining that difference and why it's so valuable and important to you guys.
Take it away, Corey.
Well, yeah, a state citizen is what I refer to the term citizen. That references Article 4 of the Constitution, or the term citizen as it's used in Article 4. A sovereign citizen, first off, that term is just contradictory. It's like calling somebody a king's subject. It just is, it's contradictory in terms in itself. But the real error in that whole kind of theory of sovereign citizenship is, in my opinion, that there's no legal mechanism to bind the government to offer you any protections if you're claiming some status that's outside of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the idea of being a state citizen is what the framers put the whole Constitution together with, that whole idea that there are citizens of the several states. And through history and just a myriad of small changes, you know, kind of like a frog in a pot, just slowly turning up the heat, over 120 years of the government constantly pushing people towards a new type of citizenship that was never even contemplated by the framers. And that's a national citizenship guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. The idea is, if you're a 14th Amendment citizen, that really is the problem. You don't have any real standing to make the government really do much of anything. And when comparing what was the status of citizens of the several states compared to what the status is of a U.S. citizen, I find it much more advantageous to restrain government by maintaining state citizenship.
Yeah, federal citizenship is the problem. I used to share with friends and family, I've never voted for a Democrat or Republican president in my life. I've voted in many elections, or I should say the birth record has voted in many elections. I've not been part of the problem. You people are part of the problem. Keep, you know, electing these these puppets. I now have shifted to that's all just a huge distraction, that the election means nothing at the federal level. It's just a total just waste of our time. Whereas what the problem is with regards to how the ills of our society manifest themselves is because we are U.S. citizens or federal citizens. And that means that you have elected as a raising your hands when you get the birth record is assigned to you, when you go to public school, when you sign up for a student loan, when you get a driver's license, when you register to vote, all of these applications are requiring you to raise your hand and say, I am a U.S. citizen. And that raising of the hand, consenting to that federal status, you're leaving behind your Article 4 state citizen status. And you're saying, I'm going to step over here and move myself into federalhood. And in that situation, you have abdicated your ability to have the Bill of Rights enforced. And that's what we primarily deal with. And Corey, the reason I'm so enamored with what Corey's been doing is that he's walking the talk in California, which is one of the largest leviathans in the world, the state of California.
Mm-hmm.
And for Corey to be able to achieve what he's done in California speaks just massive volumes that he's on to something very powerful and important. And that's why I work with Corey so much, is because I want to see him succeed.
Well said. Yeah, it is an interesting saga. We'll definitely get into it. One more thing about the sovereign citizen thing. Todd, I think you actually were the one who shared with me a little interview where it's becoming apparent that law enforcement are getting very wise and also very hostile towards people invoking what they hear from these sovereign citizen speakers out there, right?
Absolutely. It was probably two and a half years ago, Sheriff Chief Bob Powdert, P-A-U-D-E-R-T, Powdert, in West Memphis, Arkansas, just on the other side of Tennessee, came to Scott County, Iowa to give a training session for law enforcement about the dangers of sovereign citizens. And I went to that event. It was pretty fascinating, actually. And I had seen Chief Powdert on 60 Minutes. He was featured because his son was murdered roadside at a road stop by some so-called sovereign citizens. And if you look into that, there's a whole story thread there. I mean, the video doesn't really show him getting killed, but I'm sure he died. But whether or not who shot him, I'm not sure. Even Chief Powdert verbally acknowledged that to me when I spoke to him when he was here in Scott County. Mm. And the Southern Poverty Law Center, pretty much preyed upon the Powdert family's tragedy and recruited him as a spokesperson for training of law enforcement of the dangers of sovereign citizens. And I went to this event and, do you really want to go into this? Cause you can cut this if you want. It's up to you, but
sure. Give us the cliff notes at least.
Yeah. Well, I'll try and give you the cliff notes because it's fascinating. I sit down in the room, and of course, I'm waiting to be escorted out. I'm surrounded by FBI agents, all kinds of people, TSA, sheriff, police, all kind, 150 people from all over the Midwest here for this guy. And there's a booklet on the table, and in the booklet, it has a page of the most dangerous organizations, and on that, it listed the We the People Foundation. Mm-hmm. And I'm very familiar with We the People Foundation. I worked with them closely in 2009 for Continental Congress, and Bob Schultz named Bob Schultz as a dangerous individual. So at the break, none of the cops wanted to talk to Powdert, and he came right up to me and talked to me, and we spoke about that. And I said, why do you have these guys listed as dangerous? He's like, yeah, I know. That's what the Southern Poverty Law Center wanted to do. And so anyway, the reason I even bring all this up is that Powdert was sharing with everybody there that, the people that are availing themselves of the Constitution, trying to say that you have no authority, these are dangerous people. And what I tried to share with him was, those of us who are studying the Constitution are not necessarily all dangerous. And he goes, I agree with you. The federal government's completely out of control and so forth. Anyway, I don't know where I went with that. Sorry.
No, it's okay. But yeah, that's an interesting side note to this guy's crusade against sovereign citizens, is that perhaps there was manipulation, emotional manipulation on the part of the death of his son to send him off on this crusade. I mean, you can't be sure, but you do have to question everything. Manipulation can exist any step of the way. Whether or not there was manipulation, clearly they got a crusader for their campaign. I also wanted to ask you about the name of your show, Agenda 31. Where'd you get that name? Obviously, it is a play off of Agenda 21, for those who know that, right?
Correct.
It's also a nod to the 3,100 plus counties that are in the country. And that's one of the things I really like. Todd came up with this. That's one of the things that I think is really important to the show and to the success of being able to adopt a legal strategy of employing state citizenship is recognizing the significant power in the original form of government that was at the local level. And that's something that Todd and I both, you know, really find incredibly important to get into the psyche of people to understand how the system actually functions. And that helps you identify the difference between the federal and state citizenship and jurisdictions.
Right.
People don't age enough locally is the challenge. They're filled with distractions of the national elections. And originally when we started Agenda 31, we wanted to have the Fodor's guide or the Zagat guide to liberty. Meaning, like, wouldn't it be great if you could come to a website and type in, like, well, I want to see the what's the freest county in America? And what are the criteria? Well, it could be everything from, do they fluoridate the water supply? Do you get to know who your grand jury is in that county? Are you taxed to collect your rainwater in that county? You know, what's the status of freedom in that county? And we had kind of envisioned this concept of being able to access a database of 3,100 plus counties across America. So we've shifted it into, we hope to have an Article 4 state citizen in each and every county across America, and that would be 3,100 plus state citizens, and that would be a starting point for something significant.
Right on. This kind of ties into that, but I've heard you guys say on your show that a fundamental question behind Agenda 31 is, how do you identify yourself, or am I letting the government define me as they see fit? And I don't think this crosses the minds of most Americans very often at all, but elaborate on why these are important questions for people to reflect on.
Using a birth record, which is kind of the fundamental document to every engagement you have with government on a personal level. When you get your driver's license, before you can get a driver's license, you have to go down to the county recorder's office and get a certified copy of a birth record. And in California, that birth record, the original that has your mom's wedding signature on it, that's up at the Department of Public Health in Sacramento. And so you're getting a certified copy of their property, which is a person who is protected under the 14th Amendment. But the nature of that person, if you look at it very carefully, and I encourage everybody, get a copy of your birth certificate out and look at it really closely. Look at the title that they gave your mom. On mine, it says it's signature of informant. And look up the definition of what informant means. And my interpretation of the birth record is it's created in such a way that it will guarantee you 14th Amendment rights, if you want to call them rights, but it guarantees you access to citizenship under the 14th Amendment while simultaneously preventing you from citizenship in the several states. And that's because the laws in the several states are very different from what we're familiar with today. There's nobody alive today that can recollect what it was like to live under a state that operates as a Republican form of government and operates under common law. So a lot of the things that we see today that we might think, well, that's no big deal. Who cares if on the birth record, my mom used her maiden name rather than my dad's family name. Well, in these common law states, which are the several states, that's a very important subject.
We also talk about the lowest risk, highest reward. That's one of our themes. And we ask people to ask themselves, you know, what risk are you willing to take for what reward? And we assert that if you're concerned about your freedoms, if you're concerned about the overreach of the tyrannical government, whether it's at the federal level or down to your county or state level, which are all subsidiaries of the feds, by the way, if you're concerned about that, well, rather than just complain about it, do something. And we assert that the first step is to identify yourself on your own terms, not on the government terms. And that simply means making your own common law ID. And that was Corey's term. He called it a common law ID. We're shifting towards calling it an Article 4 state citizen ID. But that is an effort to say, this is who I am, and I am asserting or averring that I am a state citizen as of the year that this state entered the Union. Or when the Constitution was first formed for that state, and whether it's in Tennessee or, you know, Georgia or California or Kentucky, wherever it might be, it means you need to go look up the history of the state you live in. It means you had to do a little work, that should be pretty low risk. Look at the history of your state, your state constitution, when it was, oh, turns out that there were five constitutional conventions before the current one was ratified that the state is claiming that they're operating under. I mean, there's all, that's why we say there's 50 ways to skin this cat. Each state's going to have its own history. So we don't propose to know every state's history. We can only deal with where we live. Go make your own common law ID. We say we are domiciled in Corey's case, California, 1849. In my case, Iowa, 1846. That's our assertion or our averment of state citizenship, that we are operating under that rule of law, where that was the constitution that was passed when the state was entered into the union by that compact of states, which make up the federal government. And if you can't make your own common law ID, then you're really just kind of just, you know, pissing in the wind.
My common law ID is by far the most important document I have. Out of anything that, if I were to lose everything, if my house burned down and all the documents went away, the very first thing I would do is make another Article 4 citizen ID for myself. That is the basis of everything as far as who I am and what the status is. Todd's used his to travel on aircraft, you know, get through TSA.
Right.
I've used mine to cross the border. I've used it to enter into federal buildings. I've used it to cash money orders at the post office. It is a valid document that is a highly important thing that really, if you're buying it from somebody else, you know, there's a lot of people that put websites up that say they'll sell you. There's another guy out there who is claiming he's selling common law IDs. If somebody else is creating the ID for you, then in my opinion, it's worthless because it's something that you have to claim yourself. And if you have somebody else make it for you and you don't understand why it's created the way it is based on your own research or your own knowledge, then you're going to have a hard time defending it.
Right.
And the name of the game is, I say I am the person who's identified on my Article 4 citizenship ID. And I go about, when I'm in a contest with the government, defending that that's who I am. Their job is to get me to say or put me in a position where I am their property, which is the birth record. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important to have that common law ID. And it's not either or. You can actually have both. But to achieve any type of restriction on the government, it's only an Article 4 citizen. So somebody could kind of make their own. It's fun. It's actually really kind of neat. You can make your own ID. Keep your driver's license and kind of learn how this works. Make your own ID and go to the post office, purchase a money order, and then send it to somebody else who has a similar ID. We talk about using the authority of the 37th Congress in doing this example, where you can mail a letter for 2 cents if it's local or 3 cents if it's out of town. And the person on the other end, they could take that money order and take it to the post office and cash it with a common law ID. And now you've just completed a circle of a very primitive form of common law banking that's available to us in the country. And what's interesting is, I think Bernie Sanders has mentioned that we should be able to do additional banking at the post office recently.
Yeah, this stuff is really fascinating because it's, I guess to clarify, we're talking about two parallel governments. And over the years, it seems like we've just been kind of slowly led to believe that there's only one, and it's the federal government, and that's the rule of law, and you're under their thumb and don't even think about anything else. But I guess some of the old forms of government that were state specific are actually still in place, just kind of more covert and hidden. Is that kind of the gist here?
Yeah, that's exactly it. That this jurisdiction exists. It's an entire playing field. And that's the playing field that the framers of the country originally intended all the citizens to be. When they created Washington, D.C. after the mutiny of the Pennsylvania Line, which is just a fascinating story, that's how we ended up with a Washington, D.C. They never intended for Washington, D.C. to have citizens. And if you were to tell the framers today that the entire country is basically a U.S. citizen, I think they would find it, how in the world were they able to do that? Because in the original, there was such a separation between citizens of a state and the federal government. But the two governments, as you mentioned, there's one government that's kind of hidden. Well, there's always been two parallel governments in every state. As soon as a state entered the Union, then within the borders of that state immediately began to operate the jurisdiction and authority of the federal government. So things like the authority to coin money, that no longer is something that the state could do once it joined the Union. And that was a jurisdiction that is granted to the federal government. And of course, in California, right up near San Francisco, there was a, I'm not sure if they still operate, but there was a mint that I have a few coins that were minted from that mint when California was operating off its 1849 constitution. But if you were a citizen and you began to counterfeit money for any reason, that would be federal authority and you could absolutely be prosecuted by the feds. And those two governments operated in your state. But at the time, you know, when we're talking about when the state first entered the Union, it was very easy to tell the difference between somebody who was a federal authority and somebody who was a state authority. And in California, if you're a federal employee of any kind, you're not allowed to hold state office.
Right.
That's right in the 1849 Constitution. So the feds, which were operating right within your state, you didn't have to worry if the feds had their own citizens. They were only employees of the government. Well, after the 14th Amendment, that portion of government, which had always been there, that portion of government began to have citizens of its own, and they were from Washington, D.C. And then the government found it to be very easy over a very short period of time after the 14th Amendment to get people to participate in activities that would make them think that they are altering or adjusting their own state. But in reality, in my opinion, they were just participating in a big, big magic show. The magician got the audience to say abracadabra and out comes the rabbit, which is a new constitution here in California. But it had nothing to do with what the audience, you know, participating. It was all just a game. In my opinion, the federal government doesn't need a vote to create a constitution. The constitution that California operates under right now, which is the 1879 constitution, is an administrative government and its headquarters are located in Washington, D.C. And I send letters to local officials via the headquarters in Washington, D.C. just to demonstrate that difference in jurisdiction.
Hmm. Yeah, that's such an important point. I've heard you guys mention on the show that on paper, being a federal employee doesn't allow you to participate in state government. And that is one explanation for why the federal government expands so much, right?
Well, there's the Constitution was built in such a way that you have the states and its population adversaries with the federal government. And what the federal government has been able to do is just kind of manage all of that, make the states just be empty by voluntary consent, and they're able to maintain plausible deniability on why these states are empty. And there's nobody with standing who's been able to bring a case that is able to invoke the substantive rights associated with being an Article IV citizen. And it escapes me right now, Todd, but what was the name of that case with the sheriff? With Prince v. United States.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. P-R-I-N-T-Z. And at the same time, Sheriff Richard Mack was involved and their cases got collapsed into the same one. And the reason you bring that up, Corey, is?
Well, the Justice Thomas, who is very well known for, you know, saying very little, he wrote a concurring opinion. And in that concurring opinion, you know, from the position of being an Article IV citizen, to me, it's just the federal court screaming for somebody to bring this authority of the several states to resist the federal government.
Right on. So you guys have touched on several things that I want to get into deeper, but on the common law ID, how exactly do we go about making one for ourselves? And you talked about some of its benefits, but a lot of those benefits are also things that you can do with a typical driver's license or federal ID. What's the benefit of going with this second system, and how exactly do we make that ID for ourselves if we're interested?
I think one of the biggest benefits is that it's training yourself to be self-determinant. It's retraining your synapses in your brain. It's like exercising your Article IV state citizenship by using it. I mean, I I'll go to Best Buy, electronics store, to get a cell phone for one of my employees, and they want to see a driver's license. And I say, well, here's my ID. And, well, where's your driver's license? Well, this is my ID. And then it just starts a dialogue about what we're talking about. And they finally go, okay. Cause really they don't really need a driver's license. They needed some identification.
Right.
And you start a dialogue with people about these respective concepts. And until we're talking about this stuff, people don't even think about it. That's one benefit of using it. The other benefit I can think of is it is proof positive actions you have taken, behavior you have exhibited, that you are averring, A-V-E-R, the verb averring your state citizenship. You're not identifying yourself as government property. You're identifying yourself with a given name and a family name. You're not identifying yourself with a first name and a last name, because those identifications are labels and attributes that the government owns via the birth record. And so you have to walk the talk. It's not easy. You know, you get your genitals felt up at the airport when you use it.
Yeah.
You get a special pat down because you didn't have GovCo ID, but you know, you're standing upright.
Is that trade-off worth it? I guess that's the big question, because it seems kind of like semantics to have the second ID, especially if it's going to bring in more increased scrutiny, because, you know, I'm fighting against the clock here. We have limited time on this earth, and I want my interactions with this system to be as minimal as possible. And maybe that sounds like nails on a chalkboard to you guys who are actually trying to do much more, but.
Oh, I like minimal involvement.
Well, yeah, right. Of course. I just mean, I can understand how it might be frustrating for people doing the hard work you're doing to hear someone like me say that I don't know if I feel that it's worth it. But I have to ask you, I mean, is that trade-off really worth it?
You know, Greg, I think from looking at it from a different point of view, big picture, it is worth it. When you aver Article 4 citizenship versus being a citizen or a resident of one of the administrative states, there's a huge difference in responsibility for the federal government. Those administrative states have no guarantee to exist. There's nothing that absolutely guarantees that they can exist. They're there if they're profitable for the overlords. However, the Article 4 state is guaranteed a Republican form of government. In fact, in a court case, Texas v. White, part of what the court attributed the authority of the Civil War to be prosecuted by the North was based on the Southern states having become rebellious, and that they had an obligation to guarantee a Republican form of government to those states. So now what would happen? Think about it. If we had a system where these states were the dominant authority rather than Washington, D.C. to be the dominant authority, the benefit is just amazing. For example, in California, if you own a corporation and that corporation does something illegal, the principals of that corporation are responsible for the behavior of the company as if they were doing this themselves. Unlike the current corporations we have now, where there's nobody responsible for the behavior of these corporations. That's one huge benefit as a people that we can absolutely demand without any question that the state be run properly and that the people be guaranteed Article 4 citizenship. If there's fewer and fewer customers that are in the administrative form of government under the 14th Amendment, then it will starve this Leviathan that we're all resisting against. So I think cumulatively, Greg, if you were to take the easy road, because you're absolutely right, I don't think there's anything that I can say that makes it easier to travel around without a driver's license, without plates on the car, and having a common law ID. There's not really anything that I can say right now is a huge benefit. So for the people that are deeply concerned about what kind of world we're going to leave to our grandkids, trying to right the mistakes of our great grandparents and the financial system, the unsecure money supply, the elastic money supply that is allowed to operate because the states are not there to give competition to it. And the states, for example, California or any of the several states, they're not allowed to use fiat currency. They must pay their bills in gold and silver. And if we have gold and silver that is being circulated by employees who work for these several states, then that would put a fantastic restraint on the government's ability to, or the Federal Reserve's ability to just print unlimited numbers of Federal Reserve notes, because there would be a competing currency that would be circulating. So for the people who are, you know, at the tip of the spear, I know Todd going through the airport, it's not fun getting your nuts grabbed because you're using a common law ID. And I can tell you, it is not fun getting pulled over and having your car towed, but it does give me the standing to be able to hit back as hard as I possibly can using the authority of an Article 4 citizen domiciled in one of the states as defined in Article 4. So it's more of a big picture benefit, long-term benefit for people who are, you know, interested in preserving freedom, preserving a form of government that is much more stable than we currently have. The 1849 government is very difficult to change. It's very difficult for politicians to make wild changes to it like we currently have in our Constitution, where, you know, anybody, a union who can afford to get 500,000 signatures can put something on the ballot, add a few million bucks to it, and have a constitutional change right away, where there isn't the time to be able to, for people to understand what that change is going to be. It's all just lies that they tell. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the old form of government, that republic is incredibly stable. For the politicians to make a change, it requires a time period that involves them getting reelected before that change occurs. And there's a reason why there was hardly any changes to it. And it's a government that works much better for the people rather than the current system that we have where everybody works for the federal government.
That makes sense. That really does. And solid answer too, because there is really not going to be a victory over the system without some sacrifice, without some inconvenience. And to be on the front lines of that fight is a noble thing, especially when so many people are distracted, don't even realize it's happening. It can be probably pretty frustrating to feel those things on a personal level when the greater population is just completely ignorant. But Todd, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about flying, because flying is one of the most document heavy and regulated activities that a person in America can go through, especially in a post 9/11 world. To say that you actually got onto a plane with one of these common law IDs, I mean, this does something to kind of show that there's validity to this type of identification. How did that play out where you actually flew without a federal ID? That probably shocks some people.
Well, I have to give credit where credit's due. Phil Mosek is the first one to investigate this and walk the talk. He didn't use a common ID. He just didn't have any ID. And I believe he's from New Mexico, but was flying in Seattle. And he was, and if you just look up M-O-C-E-K, Phil Mosek, there's whole videos about him out there. And he took it to a court hearing, and it was proven in court that there is no requirement to have a government-issued ID at the checkpoint. So I offered my common law ID just as a courtesy to start the dialogue of who I say I am. I could have stepped up and said, I don't need an ID, and just, you know, let's deal with me. What do you technically, what they have to do is the TSA just has to determine that you are not on the list, the so-called terrorist list. That's their technical empirical mandate for the checkpoint to pass through, which is folly on its surface, because when the plane ticket is put in the name of the passenger, the system can check that right away and already know that here comes somebody who's, you know, on our list. Let's set them aside and grill them.
Right.
But if not on the list, why am I being talked to? and this is the travesty of the checkpoint at TSA, is that if everybody showed up and said, screw you, we're not showing you an ID, it would shut down the airlines. The airlines would be livid. The airports wouldn't have any revenue. They would go away. So it isn't really about a common law ID that got me through. It was just that I refused to use a government issued ID. And when I handed it to them, they, on my way outward, I was going to visit Corey, actually. I was flying out of a small airport out of Illinois. I mean, the audio is on our, they just were like, oh, you don't have a government. I said, this is my identification. In all fairness, he said, well, do you have anything else? I said, you know, I've got a business card. I've got a Costco card. And oh, a Costco card. Okay. All right. I can, you know. So, you know, that checked a box for him.
Corporate America.
Yeah. You still have to get it in hand. And technically, that's probably working for him, because to get a Costco card, you typically have to show a driver's license. It always goes back to that original application for who you say you are.
Mm.
And that's the thread they probably followed, if you will, to check a box. But nonetheless, I was still given an enhanced pat down and set aside. But there was no big bells and whistles. There was no freak out session. I was probably, you know, took me, you know, 7 minutes to get through instead of two. Mm-hmm. You know, so it wasn't like it was a big crisis. And I just think people should avail themselves of it more often. Imagine if all the Bernie Sanders followers decided to, you know, that fly decided to not use a government issued ID. And it would just, I've talked to TSA people. I've been in meetings with the airport that where I live here is the head of all training for all TSA in Illinois, except for Cook County, except for the Chicago area. They train every other TSA agent for Illinois. And so they have some, you know, high ups here. And I'm in morning meetings because I actually sell the advertising at this airport here. And I go to these monthly meetings and this guy's sitting there and he says out loud, there was a concern with the business community that our Illinois driver's license is going to be accepted at the checkpoint because of the National ID Act kind of on the rise. That's still kind of being pushed behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And there's some scuttlebutt about it. And he said, oh, if you don't have your ID, you know, you just need to talk to us and we'll work it out kind of thing. And I raised my hand and I said, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but technically there is no requirement to have any government issued ID to get through the checkpoint, correct? And he looked at me and he goes, yep. And then he moved on. It was like nothing to see here. Like nobody was, you know, I didn't want to make a huge scene about it, but I wanted to check the box in front of others. And he knew exactly what I was talking about. And there it is. There is no requirement.
Right. It's heavily, heavily recommended. But yeah, there's no legal requirement. All they can do is kind of use all those theater. That forceful language. Yeah.
It's total, total theater for mind control of a populace.
Right. And to your earlier point about it being a magic trick, maybe we should spend a little time on the fact that the government purposefully uses homonyms or homophones to be extra deceptive. These are those words that have the same spelling and they're phonetically the same, but have dual meanings when it's convenient. This is one of their big tricks, right?
Absolutely. So when they refer to the state of California or they use the term United States, you know, all of those are words that you have to really drill down. What are they talking about? So there's two different state of California. There's the one that we think of classically where, you know, you're in San Diego and I'm up here in Los Angeles. We're both within the borders of California. We would agree with that. But now we got to figure out which California we're in. The only one that has borders is the 1849 California. So geographically speaking, we are in, you know, are located standing on dirt that is within the territorial limits of California, one of the several states. Now, the other California operates very differently. It doesn't have borders and it's physically located in the United States. And if you look at California Commercial Code 9307H, it's very clear the United States is located in the District of Columbia. And so that state of California that is the one that they refer to is physically located at 444 North Capitol Way Northwest, District of Columbia. That's where it's located. So if you're in the California that's in the United States, it's kind of like saying you're in a religion. So there's one California that's the dirt that you stand on. There's another one that through your actions, you can be a part of, just like you could be a part of any church. And if you and I were standing outside in a park, and if I were to ask you, are you part of a church organization or are you in the church? You would know in that context, I'm not asking you right then physically, are you standing in a church? Because obviously we're outside in a park.
Right.
It's the same thing by saying you're in the state of California. They use that all the time. And what they do with the words is they'll switch them around. For example, if you go look at the limit sign, I don't know if you drive up to San Clemente at all, but there's a Orange County line and then the city of San Clemente city limit sign that is right there on the border between San Clemente and where San Onofre is. And that's a great sign because it's very clear. It says orange in big words. It just says orange. And then below it, county limit. And then below that is a sign that says San Clemente city limit. You know, if you're in either one of those jurisdictions, if somebody's giving you a problem, if you get a ticket from, a parking ticket in San Clemente, which I've gotten quite a few, then, the parking ticket comes from a organization called City of San Clemente. And that is a corporation that has a very special political power to it under the 14th Amendment. And so that's where they get you. Just I try and use the illustration of like computer code. If there's a line in computer code that requires the wording to be Orange County limit, and you were to put in County of Orange, then that particular line of computer code won't work. And right. So that's how I identify, or to begin with, that's just one of the many attributes I use to identify what is the organization that I'm dealing with. And, that's something that's really important. So.
Right on. Yeah. And another thing I wanted to go into a little more in depth was the birth record, because I hear that these birth certificates are traded on the stock market as if we are livestock, quote unquote. And I'm not sure how much truth there is to that, but do we really know the extent in which they use these birth certificates? Is that the same kind of impression you guys get too?
In California, I don't know, Todd, if you checked it out there, but I know in California, I've verified that the actual original birth record is on file at the Department of Public Health in Sacramento. It's in Department of Public Health Vital Records in Sacramento. It's a document that the state owns. I've never been able to verify any of the, you know, what I call PJN or PNJ theory of being physically traded on the stock market and all of that. That just kind of to me is a rabbit hole. I've tried to research and find some evidence of that being true, and I've not been able to find that, nor do I think they really need it, because if you're identifying yourself using a state issued birth record, then they've got you. They don't need to trade the birth record on the stock market. They control you 100%, and they control how much income you get to keep when you work, what licenses you have to have. You know, they control everything once you have subscribed yourself through a political pledge of being the person on that birth record and then operating within federal authority under the 14th Amendment.
PNJ stands for Patriot Nut Job, by the way.
Right on. Good to clarify.
And Corey and I both dealt with plenty of PNJs along the way. Many of them were well-intentioned, and that concept of the birth record or birth certificate being traded on the stock. What I think happens is that it's a very, very, they call it vital statistics for a reason in each state. And we're back to the homograph. The state I'm talking about is the administrative division of the federal government that also is known as the state of Iowa or state of California. That's the state we're talking about. You know, if you go to this little sidebar, if you go to the CIA World Factbook, we've talked about this many times on our show. If you just search for CIA World Factbook, you'll get a link to it. It talks about the each country throughout the world and what kind of government they have. And they name the states as administrative divisions right there at the CIA fact. So back to the birth certificate. I think what happens is these vital records and vital statistics agencies are being tapped for actuary information, you know, forecasting of populace, forecasting of resources, things like that. So in an empirical manner, there might be some, you know, utility to those, but only, you know, if you're the federal government and you are the thing that people have a hard time understanding is the federal government was never designed to have citizens of its own. It wasn't until the 14th Amendment they had citizens of their own. The federal government was never designed to have a direct impact to individuals. It was supposed to have an impact on the states and the state governments, so that the state and state governments played nice, so that the state and state governments didn't violate the people's rights.
Gotcha. Just like a middleman, like an intermediary between sovereign states.
It was a compact. The states decided to have a compact and have an enforcer, so we all play nice together and maintain this civility and maintain an open society. And it's been morphed into this top down. I mean, I heard, you know, on some radio show the other day, you know, President Obama is deciding a new executive order regarding overtime. And just the general concept that there would be some top down, you know, overtime shall be like this for everybody. Really? How did that happen? Where are we totally in this? We have a king now? I mean, it's incredible to me. And then the thing that Corey coined that we hammer a lot on our show about is that as a federal citizen, you are guaranteed. Corey used that term earlier. The 14th Amendment guarantees certain things. It guarantees some protections, but the protections the 14th Amendment guarantees is that the state, the other state in that homograph, the actual one of the several states, the original state, that state shall not violate your rights. And this worked for the slaves when the 14th Amendment was originally impacted, because they needed to have protections because, you know, people still wanted to have slaves even after the Civil War, and the feds had to enforce it and say, no, we're going to have the 14th Amendment. You can be a federal citizen and we'll make sure you're not violated as a slave now. And everybody's, oh yeah, I'm in. But that same protection does not apply from the federal government violating your rights. It doesn't work that way. You don't get that same protection. So you, when you signed up for federal citizenship, you signed up for violation by your very master.
Wow.
Yeah, there's absolutely no protections from the federal government upon 14th Amendment citizens other than what is statutory civil rights. And that's what, you know, you hear that term all the time, demanding your civil rights. Well, civil rights are akin to a father's right over a 4-year-old child. You know, the father may say, okay, you have the right to stay up late tonight, but if we want to change your bedtime tomorrow, we change your bedtime tomorrow. That there is just absolutely no protections on a constitutional basis between a 14th Amendment citizen being impacted directly from the federal government, unlike an Article 4 citizen. One of the biggest examples is income taxes. You know, it's obviously 100% abundantly clear to me that income taxes, in the way that they are implemented and the way that they're processed, are 100% legal, even though the federal government is not allowed to apply taxes directly upon the citizens right in the organic portion of the Constitution. And that's because the 14th Amendment citizen does not have the same protections as an Article 4 citizen.
Greg, right. I've been in the courtroom on 3 occasions here in Scott County where a judge, somebody that was being adjudicated, was, you know, struggling to protect themselves and their rights and brought up either the state constitution or the federal constitution. And on 3 occasions out loud, I've heard judges say the constitution has no place in these proceedings in this matter.
Well, that says it right there.
When you hear these things, you know, right there, right before your very eyes, the topics that Corey and I are talking about don't become so stretched or unbelievable. They're totally believable.
Right. And another thing I thought was fascinating on this same subject is in one of your episodes, you break down some language used by Obama. And of course, Obama's a constitutional law professor, I guess. And he obviously knows these things down to a T. These are the details that I think that those people should know. And when he talks, he's very careful about the terms he uses. It's clear from your breakdown that he's definitely pivoting from word to word based on its technical application.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's when there's a clip we play from time to time on there, and he's down in Mexico, and it's during what's the name of the controversy with the gun running?
Fast and Furious?
Fast and Furious.
Had reached kind of a critical mass, and he was down at some museum down there. And he said, we all know that a lot of the guns coming into Mexico are coming from the United States. But at the same time, in America, I've taken an oath of office to protect the Second Amendment, and I always will.
Mm.
But meanwhile, we're going to pass laws that keep the guns out of dangerous people's hands. And so there's that flip-flop back and forth between those two worlds right there. It's right in your face.
Yeah. Man, I thought that was so interesting because it does validate a lot of this kind of material. And, you know, growing up, the United States definitely seemed like one big blanket nation, but as I've gotten older, especially as a stoner myself, the fact that some states are radically different than other states has never really been more apparent than it is today. The fact that they do have some power, because doing my favorite habit in Texas is far different than doing it in Colorado right now. And I guess I'm curious, as you guys see it, what would the country look like today if it was run as intended? Would all the states basically be their own sovereign nations with their own rules as different as they wanted them to be?
Absolutely.
As abrogated. Yeah, that's exactly it. As abrogated by the Constitution. There are certain natural laws that the states have to follow. And in order for them to maintain and, you know, maintain their Republican form of government, if they don't, if they begin to misbehave, then there's certainly remedy available for Article 4 citizens to be able to take their own state to federal court for violations of constitutional protections that are at the federal level. So they can't just go crazy, but the restrictions on these states in their relationship with Article 4 citizens is nothing short of profound compared to what we're used to today. To most citizens today, traveling along in your car and getting pulled over for what is really no crime at all, you know, maybe doing 65 and a 55, is if you were driving safe and not put anybody in danger or anything like that, that type of activity becomes a crime. When I say that type of activity, I mean somebody dressed up in a uniform, pulling you over, accosting you, arresting you, and then making you go through the administrative process that we know as traffic courts. Well, in these Article 4 states, that type of behavior is completely unconstitutional. And so we just haven't had, as a people, the technology has not been available for people to be able to research the massive volumes. I mean, one thing that the government's really good at is profiting from confusion. And looking at old newspapers and then the way the 1879 Constitution was passed, what was in that Constitution, the average person would just have no clue back in 1879 that their government was being hijacked. And they would just willingly identify themselves as citizens of this new government simply because they just didn't have the tools that we have available today. Today, I can do a word search in a PDF document to find out how many times the term United States is being used in that document, and then scan it really quick and ingest that information, critical information, in a matter of minutes rather than it taking hours, you know, to get to a library and so forth that people had before. So today, the work, the job of being able to identify which state you're in as a citizen is much easier than it was 20 years ago. And so I think it's just, I kind of got off on a tangent on searching, but this is absolutely attainable.
Speaking of ingesting things, Greg, you brought up, you know, marijuana in Colorado versus Texas. And to that point, consider the nuance there that, you know, we think that there's the ability to ingest marijuana in Colorado has been granted now. You know,
right.
It's hilarious when you think about it, just on its face. You know, a weed that grows out of the ground is now you're allowed to eat it or smoke it or do whatever you want, right? Oh, wow.
Absolutely.
Pay a tax, and only if you have a license. I mean, it becomes even more laborious. And so that's the federal government allowing discretion with their administrative division called Colorado. And so there's this perception that, wow, it's state's rights. Well, enough people wanted to have it. Okay, we're going to let them do it, but by God, it's going to be taxed heavily, and we're going to get a piece of it now. And in an Article 4 state, you know, that necessarily would not happen. There wouldn't even be a law against marijuana to begin with.
Right. Earlier, that was a great point about profiting from confusion. That is definitely what they do. Creating ambiguity is a term I use a lot. And that's exactly how all these different sectors operate, especially the economic system. You know, they want it that way so that you don't understand any of these terms that are going on, default credit swaps, all this kind of stuff. It just, you tune out from it because it's so complex. Yet this is where the rubber meets the road. This is where, you know, everybody's being fleeced. And only because you don't want to dial into the technical applications of some of this stuff, you really just, you let it all happen. Or at least, you know, the larger citizenry does.
They just go with the flow because it's a path of least resistance. And of course, a lot of the things you've spoken about on and guests you've had on your show are dealing with the things that have dumbed America down, whether it's vaccinations or what they put in the drinking water.
Yep.
I mean, it's all part of the mix, what they're spraying us with. It's all there. It's all what keeps everybody dumbed down. And, you know, we talk about how it's easier to fool a U.S. citizen than it is to convince him he's been fooled.
Amen. It definitely is. And another point, you talked about the court system earlier, and having dealt with a lot of this, both of you guys, is there much of a difference between superior court and federal court? And does either really have the best interest of the people in mind?
Well, you know, I have not been in a federal court action yet. Everything that I've put together is geared towards heading to a federal court action, but I want to be incredibly prepared and have the absolute best foundation I possibly can. And that requires me to engage with the administrative government here in California. And so at the administrative level, the superior courts are courts of the United States. You know, they openly show the flag with the gold fringe on it, which I interpret as indicating through from a basis of executive authority that you're in United States jurisdiction in these courts. You're not in one of the several states. And those courts, their job is to protect the infrastructure from U.S. citizens and then fleece as much as they possibly can. And I have some good friends here in California that have dedicated a tremendous amount of time to working within the system and fighting, you know, traffic tickets, registration tickets, and so forth. And they lose not because their arguments aren't sound. It's because the authority in these jurisdictions are, you're going to lose. That's just how it is. So when I engage with, for instance, the Superior Court, there's limitations on their authority. If you can show that they're blatantly violating the rights of an Article 4 citizen and willfully ignoring evidence of maybe misconduct by prosecutorial agencies, then my opinion is I would be able to have standing to create an action with not only the courts, but the other parties involved as well as other government officials in a federal action under Article 3. In Article 3 is there's a diversity of citizenship. So my citizenship is different than the citizenship of these courts, the Superior Court. And so the proper jurisdiction when that event occurs would be at the federal level. And so my documents that I submit and my defense in the case is all geared towards just exposing that difference between citizenship, that there's a diversity there, and then also dealing with any of the documents that they may be able to produce that would show I willingly consent to their jurisdiction. And so that would be being able to show that the signature that I had previously placed on a driver's license application is no longer valid because I've taken the steps to rescind that signature. So all of the obligations associated with the driver's license don't apply because they don't have my consent for it. That's some of the information that I try and get on the record. I don't expect to win at the state level. I guess I'll put it that way, that I don't expect there to ever be a win. Either the case will be dismissed before it ever goes to trial, or if it goes to trial, it'll require me to go to federal court and file for perhaps injunctive relief of some sort. Now, and having gone to federal court, you know, at least here in Los Angeles on Spring Street, when you walk in, there's a big sign that says ID, you know, positive photo ID is required to get through the security checkpoint. And when I was in federal court there just doing some research about 3 weeks ago, and all I had brought with me was my common law ID to get through the checkpoint. I hand it to him, and it was a female marshal. And she said she had never seen that before and showed it to her supervisor. The supervisor responded by saying that's a valid state ID. And I went right through the checkpoint without any delay at all. Maybe the whole delay was 40 seconds tops, but they were very, very polite and treated me no different than somebody, you know, who's showing a government issued ID as far as granting access to the courts. Now, I would say that's because at the federal level, to the courts, they presume, and this is in, you know, court cases where they presume that the original states, the several states exist, and it's presumed that those states have citizens of their own. And that's plainly stated again in Texas v. White. I think one of the most interesting cases anybody could read is the history around Texas v. White. Because it does show that case happened in the time period when Texas was going from the original republic that entered the Union to being a administratively controlled government under military rule. And the difference between the two is plainly stated by the judiciary that the original government is guaranteed to exist forever. And that it's presumed forever to have citizens of its own. And when Mr. White had taken this case to court, there wasn't the mechanisms yet that the federal government had created that we have today. There wasn't the IRS. There wasn't driver's licenses. There wasn't all these other mechanisms that could bind you to 14th Amendment citizenship. So the presumption was, and it was correct, is that his citizenship was sourced under Article 4 of the Constitution, and he prevailed. And it was over a monetary, you know, it was a monetary battle, but it's still a very fascinating case. And so when you get to the federal level, at least in theory, the federal courts would presume that it's completely normal for somebody who's identifying themselves as an Article IV citizen to come to their court to deal with an administrative agency that is sourced out of Washington, D.C., operating within the defined territory of their state.
And Greg, we're not claiming that we're 100%, you know, knowledgeable and everything we are asserting is I mean, where I'm going with this is a lot of people, we're not claiming we have a system that's perfect. We're not claiming that this is what you have to do. We're just claiming do something. It's different than what you're doing now, because I know people that have wasted is too strong a word, have invested dozens and dozens of years of their lives and their family treasure to trying to fight this battle up at the federal level and to the highest level, just beneath the Supreme Court, and been told time and again, no standing, because they continued to apply themselves as this ens legis entity, this creature of law called a birth certificate. And we're allowed to have this facsimile that we have rights that are protected, like the First Amendment. But then why, if the First Amendment's so protected, how do you have free speech zones on college campuses? Because there's discretion, because you're a federal citizen, and in a federal citizenry, we get to have discretion.
Well said. And I mean, it makes sense. You're testing the system. And I think that's a noble cause. And it's obviously tough because nobody is giving you the tools to succeed. You have to try different mechanisms and see what works. And the feds have a lot of different tricks and illusions to kind of keep you down.
We're hopeful that there's white hats out there, Greg, that get this and know it. And we think one of them might be Justice Thomas.
Right on.
Yeah. And cause he wrote in that Prince case, the sheriff, it was about the Brady Bill. It was about enforcing gun control at the local level. And it got, and the sheriffs prevailed. But it was considered a 10th Amendment prevailment. It wasn't anything to do with diversity of citizenship. It was just about 10th Amendment. And he wrote that the Second Amendment appears to contain an express limitation on the government's authority. The court has not had recent occasion to consider the nature of the substantive right safeguarded by the Second Amendment. However, if the Second Amendment is read to confer a personal right to keep and bear arms, a colorable argument exists that the federal government's regulatory scheme, at least as it pertains to the purely intrastate sale or possession of firearms, runs afoul of that amendment's protections. As the parties did not raise this argument, however, we need not consider it here. Perhaps at some future date, the court will have the opportunity to. And that's where that would be kind of the long ball play, if you will, is to have somebody withstanding to answer that call that we think he put out there.
All right on. And this is another thing that was touched on a bit earlier, but can one of you guys talk to us about the legal name and its importance as to how it's formatted? What is so important about going by first, middle, last name as opposed to the terms given name and surname?
Well, it's the title. So the way I interpret the Constitution as having been put together, to use a military example, the title of given name and surname or given name and family name would be akin to being general, whereas the title first, middle, last name would be again akin to being, you know, a conscripted private cannon fodder. And, you know, when it comes to dealing with government, I want them to view me as the highest political standing possible, not something that's just their property to be fleeced. And if you're invoking or responding to what, you know, I think is really just a slave name by using those titles, first, middle, last name, and saying, yeah, that's me, you're literally identifying yourself as government property because the government owns the property that you're using to say, yeah, that's me.
Mm-hmm. Kind of another trick with the homophone thing, right?
Yeah.
Two terms that sound exactly the same.
Absolutely. And it's ingrained in us from birth. When I first started to understand this, trying to separate the two in my head and be able to get clarity on this was very difficult. And I later learned that the reason why it's so difficult in the beginning is literally the connections in your brain to recognize how important it is or to recognize the difference You're not used to being addressed by your given and surname. Yet if you have a passport, open it up and look at it. On the passport, it says bearer as far as where your signature goes. It doesn't say applicant or owner or anything else. It just says bearer and then lists your name, given and surname. Now there's a reason why it's done that way. Because if you were to be identified as a state issued birth record outside of the country, then you wouldn't be recognized as a citizen. And, that's part goes into all the different treaties that surround passports and so forth. But, the training from day one in school, you're taught first, middle, last name, date of birth. When you get pulled over, or if a cop, you know, approaches you and says, you know, what's your first name? What's your last name? What's your date of birth? All of these things are just ingrained in us from such a young age that it is a personal challenge for each and every one of us who wants to aver Article 4 citizenship to be able to not submit to that type of title. And it's a title that the government wishes to impose on you. And you notice it when you no longer want to accept that title. I mean, I've had that. In fact, when I was put in handcuffs at the beach in San Clemente, it was simply because the officer wanted me to say first, middle, last name. And I kept responding saying, I don't have a first name. I've got a given and surname. And if it's not a big deal, then why would they need to handcuff you over it? Mm-hmm. You know, if they could just scratch out on a ticket. All right. Well, doesn't matter what your title is on your name. We'll scratch out this thing that says first name and we will put given name here. And that should make you happy. Well, they can't. Because it would be similar to scratching out conscripted private cannon fodder title and then replacing that with general. And that's just not something that's going to fly. So it's the same thing. And in my, you know, I've got a court case going on right now where I'm requesting the court grant a motion to compel the state to produce evidence. And some of that evidence is geared towards showing the difference between the political status of an Article 4 citizen using a given and surname versus a 14th Amendment citizen using first, middle, last name construction. And in the, you know, when an officer gives a ticket, the rules that are established by the California Judicial Council requires that it shall be in the specific sequence of first, middle, last. So to them, it's incredibly important. And, you know, there's nothing that I find beneficial to granting them that. So I deny them in my personal life the ability to address me first, middle, last name whenever possible.
Right. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I do respect you guys a lot for putting yourself out there. And you have been talking the talk and walking the walk for a long time on this subject, educating listeners along the way. Have you had any personal victories from your listeners over the years that are worth sharing?
Well, there's lots of small victories. The big victory that I think we're looking for is a court case that, you know, in modern times, in our era, says that the federal government has an obligation to guarantee a Republican form of government to the states. And so far, nobody has brought that issue or has successfully brought that issue in a federal court case. There's been lots of people who have attempted to argue a similar thing. But when you really break down what they're arguing that the state that we see today, these administrative states that are running, are separate, when in fact they're not. They're missing the Article 4 argument. So the big win, that once that win happens, then it's going to become incredibly easy for anybody to aver Article 4 citizenship. But until that happens, there are a whole bunch of little wins. I've got a friend here who actually lives in North Hollywood. He's been traveling now for a long time with no plates, no driver's license. And he was pulled over about 2 months ago from the Highway Patrol, and they let him go. So in a case like that, there's nothing to prove that it was a win other than they asked him questions, and it was probably officers, since it was in the area, it was probably officers from the West Valley Division. They might be familiar with the contact that I have. But either way, he kept his property and continues to keep his property and continues to function as an Article 4 citizen without having gone to court. So his contact with the officers was, you know, textbook example. Like I say, if I get pulled over, I roll down all my windows. I pay rapt attention to the directions that the officer is giving. I turn on you know, Mr. Polite as much as possible while maintaining my status, and then mentally prepare that if the officer is going to take me to jail, that's an absolute possibility. But I engage with the officer in such a way that I want to encourage them, or I want to win their hearts and minds so that they hope that I win. Because if I, even though it's a direct engagement with the officer, if I win, so do they. We're all better off with a government that runs better. Mm-hmm. And we're all better off with a system of government that doesn't have such centralized control that we have today. And so, you know, I mean, I've had officers, especially the Orange County Sheriff, I've had those officers be very kind to me and nice to me. In fact, one time when I was at the clerk's window at the Orange County Superior Court, I was looking to access public information. And I forget if they wanted me to show ID or something like that, but basically through an intimidation tactic, they hit the panic button. And they've done this to me a few times. When they hit the panic button, that means there's going to be sheriff's deputies that come running with guns. They're expecting an emergency, when really the court clerk is just using that to intimidate. Mm. And so I just stay calm, maintain my position. And those officers showed up. They appropriately addressed the situation. And within a minute or two, they left. And they didn't infringe or anything upon how I was engaged with the government, even though the court clerk really did not like at all what I was saying or how I was going about asserting my authority. The sheriffs recognized there was no breach of the peace and let me go. I have been placed in handcuffs before. I've had, you know, numerous contacts with police, but for the most part, I really can't complain about the physical treatment that I've received. But I credit that to paying just rapt attention to playing my part. And that is making sure that they don't ever have use of violence being approved by policy.
Mm-hmm. And Greg, we do share stories on our show with people that are retweeting or emailing or chatting us in our chat room about what they've done. There's a lot of public records acts across. There's people engaging their state senators, asking about state citizenship. Corey got a note from a guy that said he was on a tram or a subway with a cop and sort of asked him about his oath of office, and he got right off at the next stop and, you know, fled, you know, didn't want to hear about it anymore. It's a consciousness that's happening. It's not huge by any stretch because everybody's so distracted with Hillary and Bernie, you know, and the Trumpisms and all that stuff. But the other thing that I would say about, you know, if you've ever heard of the term tar baby?
Yes.
Yeah. So, if, you know, the tar, if they take Corey in and arrest him, it's a tar baby. They took his car away. It is now a tar baby because of them taking his car away on the side of the road. There is a situation now that is uncovered that the Secretary of State has sent a letter that says they have no oaths of office on file for any California Highway Patrol officers. There's 10,000 officers in the state. They're the Secret Service of the governor, and they don't have any oaths of office? We have it in writing from the Secretary of State? It just opens up all these other doors. So It's tar baby time if you get arrested, if you know what you're doing and you've averred yourself properly. And you do have to – this isn't for everybody. It just isn't. We know that. We're not expecting it to be. But we're hopeful that, you know, there's books written about the three percenters. You ever heard of that term?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With 3% of a populace with civil disobedience or asserting themselves, you can move a society. So, you know, that's, you know, we're at 3.1% with Agenda 31. We're hopeful that you can get that kind of thing going.
Yeah. Well, great advice. Well said. And, you know, from my perspective, if you haven't been in handcuffs at least once, then you're not living. You know, you're way too complacent. but guys, thanks for sticking around. I know we went a little bit long. This is super interesting. I appreciate what you do. Very informative. And you guys are fighting the good fight for people who aren't even aware and in some cases don't appreciate it. So let me thank you on their behalf and mine. I'm really glad we were able to do this. Before we go, please remind the people where to dig a little deeper and to catch your show.
Yeah, agenda31.org is the website. We typically broadcast our show on Saturdays. It just varies. We do a live stream at agenda31.org/stream. If you subscribe at our blog, it's a WordPress blog. There's a subscription button, complimentary subscription. We'll send out a notice about 2 hours before we go live if you want to check it out live. Otherwise, you can get it on all the RSS feeds like iTunes and others to subscribe. We're also played back on the No Agenda stream at noagendastream.com on Thursdays and Sundays. after the No Agenda Show with Adam Curry and John C. Dvorak, which is a show, I think, which is a stream I think, Greg, your show should be on as well.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about making that happen. But
and on the channel ID thing, just so you know, if you subscribe to our blog, we have one section that is how to make a common law ID, which the price of admission is just subscribing to the blog and you get access to it. And you can see Corey's common ID, my common ID, and there's a template there and some more explanation about it.
Nice. Awesome. Well, Todd, Corey, thanks again. Keep it up and take care of yourselves out there.
Greg, thank you very much. Greg, it's been excellent talking with you.
Yeah, you too.
Boom. There we have it, people. Todd and Corey of Agenda 31 at an extra 15 minutes, no less. Can't complain about that. Big thanks to them for being here. And big thanks to Meme Troll on the Plus Show forums for the suggestion. Whenever I draw blank on who to have on the show, I look at the endless list of suggestions on the guest request forum. And I know I'll never get to a lot of them, but I thought what Todd and Corey are doing was interesting enough to dedicate an episode to it. And I'm glad we did. It's a little refreshing to hear an alternative to the sovereign citizen stuff, because that seems like more trouble than it's worth. It almost seems like the sovereign citizen stuff could be a big distraction from what Todd and Corey are doing, because there's actually an underlying basis for the fight they're fighting. And I feel bad because I think I was a little critical at times during the episode, but I actually think what they're doing is really intriguing, and I like their low risk, high reward approach. I think that's the only way to go about it in the modern world. But why not mess with the system? Why not draw a little attention to the underlying framework that they'd rather we ignored? I realize that if everyone just keeps their head down and says, I don't want any trouble, then nothing will ever change. So I think this is an interesting way to engage with the system that's a bit more measured than other people in this space have talked about in the past. I don't know if I'm going to do too much of this personally, but I might. I've been thinking about it. I mean, why the hell not? But I am going to keep up with what they're doing and how Corey's saga unfolds. If you liked the first hour, that's really what we talked about in the Plus Show. We got into how Corey and Todd have used these things in their own lives, and we got into their backgrounds and stories a bit too. In particular, we talked about the sunflower seed incident. And they also gave us more details on how to make our own Citizen 4 IDs if we so choose. They just seem like cool, level-headed, like-minded guys, and they've definitely done their research. Legal research, too. You gotta give a guy extra credit for that kind of stuff. But that's the show. Many of you probably saw this episode coming in the first THC newsletter on the first of the month. Lots of great responses came back to that, too, which I do appreciate. Sign up at thehiresidechats.com if you want to get in on it next month, or don't. It's just a free little extra thing, not a big deal, but thanks for listening. Either way, we have exceeded my wildest dreams. I am a lucky guy, and I hope I can keep bringing you great shows with amazing guests week after week from here to eternity. And I don't think that's too much to ask, but it's a long road to eternity. And for today, I think I've done my part. Your move, political perpetrators of the federal fantasy. Your fucking move.
Well, they tie that yellow ribbon round the oak tree. They've worn out all the prayer in their hearts. All along thought they were rooting for the home team. As they're sent to the game and torn apart, we twist this tourniquet upon the pipeline that he carries on. They've worn out all the hope in their arms. All alone. that's where they found me.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehiresidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the five shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provided all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site if you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices. I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the 5 shows the previous month and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?